Hello, good morning and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg with your Friday edition of the Biz News Briefing. Thanks for being with us. Today we talk Western Cape property, retail, the retail sector in South Africa, and mining. We'll also find out at the end of the show why the Americans are releasing the brothers, Menendez, who have been immortalized, I suppose you could say, in a Netflix feature called Monsters. But let's kick off with the news headlines. Today I've given you a little clip from our partners at the Financial Times of London, and following that up from our partners at Bloomberg, because they're two stories that are really worth for us in South Africa to actually pick up on.
Tesla has its charge back. The electric vehicle company's shares leapt an eye-watering 22% on Thursday. That's after reporting that its profits last quarter beat analysts' estimates. It also forecast, quote, slight growth in sales this year. But CEO Elon Musk really got investors excited when he predicted that sales could increase by 30% next year. This is all a pretty big deal because Tesla's had a few disappointing quarters, while global demand for EVs has slowed down. Musk said this growth will come from cheaper prices and lower interest rates on monthly payment plans.
Shares in Boeing were down more than 1% in the regular session. That's after striking workers rejected a new labor contract. It would have increased their wages by 35% over 4 years. However, the agreement failed to restore a pension plan with guaranteed sums. This is a blow to CEO Kelly Ortberg, who's been trying to stabilize Boeing after a series of setbacks. Bloomberg intelligence analyst George Ferguson says any thought of a turnaround this year is shot.
All of your increase in production, getting up the levels that are going to create profitability and cash flow, that's pushed into the back half of 2025. So it's a really long runway right now.
George Ferguson there from Bloomberg Intelligence.
And Tesla is in the Biz News portfolio. It's got 10% stake, or weighting rather, in the Biz News Shift portfolio. I'm looking at that on the site right now, up 31% since we bought it in there. And in the WebTrader portfolio, it has an 8% share, and it's up 55% there. So go Elon and the Biz News community, I'm sure, delighted with that. Well, a stock that we may be bringing into the portfolio, or maybe we should have at some point in the past, is one that is focused on Western Cape properties. It reported interims yesterday. Quinton Rossi, the chief executive from Spear REIT. Just explain to us, Quinton, a REIT, what exactly? It says it's REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust. What does that actually mean, and why is that different from a company that is just a property-owning company listed on the stock market?
Morning, Alec, and morning to your listeners. Alec, the REIT structure is a globally adopted property vehicle, effectively, which is listed on various exchanges globally. And the principle is basically an aggregation of real estate or income-producing assets. And then specific countries have specific legislation that govern the REIT operations. As an example, one of the hallmarks of a REIT is that a REIT is not liable for capital gains tax, which then incentivizes us to dispose of assets and redeploy assets. But also the REIT is a conduit pipe of income to shareholders. So if a REIT pays out 100% of its profits, it doesn't pay any tax on those profits, but the tax is paid in the hands of the shareholder. A non-REIT property company will still be liable for taxes because they don't comply with the REIT legislation in South Africa, which is a very easy step. A REIT cannot have more than a 60% loan-to-value on its balance sheet. It has to own more than 300 million rands worth of assets. 75% of its income must be derived from rental properties, and it must distribute a minimum of 75% of its profits annually. to its shareholders. And REITs are extremely attractive, especially for the pension funds, because they get a tax-free dividend effectively. And REITs have become known to pay dividends every 6 months, which also then fits quite nicely into either a private client, institutional investor, or pension fund investment basket. Because if REITs become more and more predictable in terms of their income, those three investor segments will get sustainable income going forward as an investment. And that kind of sums up what a REIT is and why it's been adopted in South Africa. Historically, we had the property loan stock and property unit trust structure, which had its own tax consequences. And then the introduction of REIT legislation just brought South Africa in line with global standards, which then started to attract international institutional capital into the SA-listed property environment, which obviously we all welcome as REITs are also capital hungry.
Nice. So a good nutshell then of what REITs are. If you are a investor and you're looking for income streams, this seems to be a place to go. But if you are looking to be engaged in the property market, well, it seems to be the place to go as well, because then you can actively manage your portfolio. Your portfolio is actively managed, Quinton, only in quite the Western right. Cape, though. So if you go back to when you started, how did this evolve, or were there some really smart guys around at the time who said, hang on, the Western Cape is a good place to be focusing our attention. It's going to do better than the rest of South Africa. So that's where we should be putting into this ultimate long-term investment, which is property. Just take us through the story.
Yeah, Alex. So I was very fortunate that I've got two incredible business partners that co-founded Sphere with me, industry legend Mike Flax and Abu Varacha. And at the time when we sat down and at the inception of Sphere, we had the hindsight experience of Mike selling Spearhead into Redefine, and we found that real estate really is the business of local markets. And if we wanted to create something of substance and something that we could create quite a lot of value out of, both for us and for ultimately into the future for shareholders, we had to be close to our assets. And the Western Cape was already back then in 2011 starting to decouple itself from the rest of the South African macro, both in terms of a GDP growth perspective, tourism growth perspective, et cetera. And we then had the opportunity to out of Redefine, because Redefine were undergoing their own evolution at that point in time. And we aggregated these assets. And the first 2 years between 2011 and 2013, all that I was doing was focusing on renewing leases, extending leases, and creating value, and then gearing up that portfolio to acquire additional assets. And that's really how we started. We basically put in some equity, and the bank, NetBank, came along and really partnered with us even up to this day. And we just started to acquire real estate assets within only the Western Cape. And for us, that focus has benefited us in so many ways. And nobody could have foreseen even the COVID pandemic. And during the pandemic, being within the region and being focused within one metro, 99% within one metro, really allowed us to defend our business in more ways than just tenant engagement. It allowed us to really just acutely manage the ups and downs of that specific trading environment. And now, as you've seen the kind of real divergence between municipal infrastructure in the Western Cape versus the rest of the country, our investment case has just been strengthened by the population growth in the Western Cape, semigration, the FDIs into the Western Cape by global players like Amazon have just underscored our rationale for just focusing on one region. Because for us, a REIT, as you said, it's an income fund. And for us, we want to be able to grow our income base in probably the best geographically focused property fundamentals in South Africa.
That's a good story. And do investors appreciate it? And what I'm getting at here is there a difference between the yield that they ascribe to your stock and other companies that perhaps have a much more diversified portfolio outside of just the Western Cape?
Yeah, I would definitely agree that we do trade at a premium rating. By my assumptions, we probably have about 100 to 120 basis point premium rating because of our regional focus. If you look at listed property, currently is trading at about a 23% discount to its net asset value and probably trading on about a 9% forward yield, if I can call it that. Spear at this point in time is trading at about a 17% discount to its net asset value. And it's not even in any index yet, which means that any index inclusion within the next year or so would actually boost, would probably create another re-rating opportunity. And also we're trading at about an 8.8% forward yield based upon current share price over forecasted distributions. So I think that investors do give us that thumbs up in terms of our rating. I think secondly, if I look at the improvement in our liquidity together with the introduction of some really great institutional investors over the last year, both some which have taken off benchmark bets on Spear and some which have made Spear a core holding within their portfolio, we can see in our liquidity, we've just been upgraded to a ZA002 rating, which means that you can trade in and out of Spear north of 30 million rand worth of value per month, which is really great for institutional investors, hedge funds, which create that liquidity in addition to private clients. And I think the other real benefit is that investors that are still looking for SA-focused indirect real estate exposure but don't want exposure to other municipalities and other metros in the country, they find a quality, sustainable income-producing opportunity within Spear because of its Western Cape focus. But the focus is the specialization, but the diversification is also important, and hence we invest into industrial, retail, mm-hmm. and commercial plus mixed-use assets.
Quinton, you sell it well. You sell it well. I remember your predecessor, Mike Flex. I recall him coming to our Ibantlas many years ago, and he also was talking the story, which has now come to fruition. But the numbers aren't that great for the past year. Headline earnings were down 3%. Your distribution, in other words, your increase in dividend, only up 2% in the six-month period. Sorry, not the last year, in the six-month period on the same time last year. So what gives? It's a good story. You don't have too many vacancies. Are you struggling to bump up the rentals in the Western Cape despite the demand that appears to be there?
Alec, I think we need to put that all into context. I think we've been operating in a very tough trading environment as a country. There's been no economic growth. We're only now 200 days free of load shedding, which obviously had a big limiting impact on the real estate sector. And I think that's something that one cannot kind of discount. In terms of the SA property sector, Spear currently is probably one of the only funds in the sector, one of maybe three, in the entire SA REIT sector that's actually printing distribution growth to its shareholders. The rest of the sector is still between negative 5% and negative 10% distribution growth. So I think one has to just take that into context. And I think the headline earnings per share and earnings per share metric for a property company would probably not be a fair shake. We would prefer to be judged, and the market judges us on our distributable income per share and our distribution per share. And being able to grow in an environment where there's a lot of cost constraints and a lot of operating cost creep is actually a mean feat in this trading environment. And as we enter a declining interest rate cycle, we'll start to see probably from next year and the year thereafter that inflation, kind of inflation-linked or inflation-beating growth, will start to come back into the sector. And we're seeing vacancies. We've filled about 10,000 square meters of vacant space in the last 6 months. After the positive outcome of the elections, the formation of the GNU, companies are now willing to take a bit more risk in terms of expansion, in terms of CapEx allocations within South Africa and specifically within the Western Cape, within our lived experience. So I think those kind of green shoots will start to filter through across the sector. I think the two-part system, some think it's great, some don't think it's great, but I do think it's going to have some benefits within our retail portfolios, specifically putting a bit more money into the consumer's pocket. And also, you know, with the rand strengthening, it has kind of weakened a bit now, but we're not importing so much inflation, which means that the Saab can, you know, take maybe a bit more of a philosophical view on cutting interest rates by 50 basis points instead of 25 basis points. So all those factors are the blocks that kind of build towards distribution growth. But yeah, I think from a Spear perspective, we're very happy with the growth in comparison to the rest of the sector. And our shareholders have obviously also given us the thumbs up on the growth. They think that we're on the right path.
Quentin Rossi is the chief executive of the Spear REIT. The focus there on the Western Cape certainly paying off. The share price hasn't done much in the last 5 years, but in the last few months, it's been one of the top performers on the JSE, up from early sevens, 7 rands, now nearly 10 rand. So it is a beneficiary of the Government of National Unity. Well, still in the Western Cape, my colleague Chris Steyn has been following the Vilgenhoff story at Stellenbosch University, as many people in the Western Cape and elsewhere in South Africa have been doing. And she spoke yesterday to Jan Rabie, who is from the group, the association, that has been fighting a decision by the Stellenbosch University Council to close Vilgenhoff, a historic residence, on the grounds of some reports, there was a lot of investigation into it, that it was a hotbed of abuse, racism, etc. For some people, and I spoke yesterday to Richard Wilkinson, who is an author who's been following the Pretoria Girls story, which turned out to be highly politically charged and a lot of bunk. To some people, it's a repeat of that. But for the Vilgenhoff grouping that are fighting the change, there has been some good news. Let's pick up with that interview, a little clip of it, and you can watch and listen to it on BizNews TV and BizNews Radio with my colleague Chris Steyn and Jan Rabie.
Yeah, what they agreed to is that the Vilgenhoff community will be moved out of the residence for 3 to 6 months next year. The community will be moved together into another residence, and they will be moved back together. They will also be allocated first years in the normal course, and the university will recognize the elected house committee. So in short, the Vilgenhoff community is being kept intact, even though they will be out of the physical building for a period of up to, but no longer than 6 months. That is the first important point. Secondly, they've agreed to take part in a facilitated process with representatives of both the university, the residents, and others in order to come up with a rejuvenated, reimagined residence, as the university has described it. And then finally, there is a process around the name of the residence, whereby both the current residents and the university have input into a potential name change of the residence, but with, call it, certain guardrails on both sides in case a consensus cannot be reached. I think it is a big step forward, and it's certainly a victory for the current residents for the reasons that I've described. The fact that the Vilgenhoff community is being kept together, that residents are staying with their friends at the end of the day, as opposed to the community being scattered into different residences across Stellenbosch, particularly taking into account the stigma, in a sense, that's been attached to Vilgenhoff residents. I think it was very important that the community be kept together and that continuity remains, and that the Vilgenhoffers will be able to go back into Vilgenhoff as one group, is a very positive outcome for the residents, but also from the perspective of the Alumni Association.
Evan Walker is with us. Gee, Evan, good to see you. Thanks for joining us this morning. 361 is the company that you and Cy Jacobs work for. And Evan, we asked you to come here to talk about Clicks, big company in South Africa, and I'd like you to give us some insight there. But before we start, sure, feels like another lifetime that the two of us were trekking around Australia with Sean Summers and Pick and Pay. How's Sean doing with his new his renewed gig?
Sure. Morning, Alec. Yeah, I think it's must be a tough start for Sean coming back to a business that really hasn't performed well. Quite a shame to have his flagship like Pick and Pay, you know, which has been significantly underinvesting for the last, call it 15 years. And then you've had this big mammoth ShopRite just come and take significant market share in a landscape which has been tough, and just sort of triple invest what anyone else has invested. And we've certainly seen it come through in the likes of their Checkers stores, et cetera. And obviously now their online offering, and obviously their 60-60 to customers, which is just sort of unrivaled now in South Africa. So, yeah, you know, heads up to Sean coming back to obviously, you know, take over the realms at a tough point in the South African economic cycle. He's got some interesting things happening there, obviously with the listing of Boxer. You know, some quite big value to unlock potentially in Boxer. It's a great business. That end of the market, they seem to be able to challenge ShopRite. You know, we've had quite extensive discussions with ShopRite and obviously with Boxer as well. And there seems to be still quite a big element of that market, which the listed retailers can play in and take market share from. You know, quite a big cash and carry market that still exists out there in the South African marketplace. So Boxer's exciting. It's coming to market quite soon. Hopefully we see an uplift in the Pick and Pay share price, which will effectively, you know, see some cash coming into that in the region of about 9 billion rand. So yeah, we're hopeful that, you know, off that balance sheet, Sean is able to restore some confidence in the Pick and Pay brand again. But it's going to be a tough ask still, Alec, going forward. Yeah. But we certainly do go back to the early 2000s when we visited Australia and saw even back then, you know, the Clicks business in Australia called Priceline, which they obviously did well to exit very soon in their growth phase.
It's quite interesting that, and I guess it's a subject for another day on how South Africans have really been hammered in Australia. Just about everybody who went there got a hiding. But here in South Africa, Clicks is doing the business. And I found it really interesting going through the annual report yesterday on the major shareholders. And apart from the PIC, the Public Investment Corporation, of all of the top 10 shareholders, not one is South African. They're all foreigners. They're foreign companies. So it's almost like they've said, we like this company. It's done a 20% compounded growth for shareholders over the last 10 years. It's going to be delivering the goods. Since the GNU, the stock has really gone very well. Yesterday's results, though, would that give them more confidence to perhaps even increase their stakes? Or would it now start getting the local guys to say, hang on, we might have been overlooking Clicks?
I think it is myself even critical of this, Alec. We've obviously looked at Clicks. It's been a great business, and there's a number of reasons. We can discuss those reasons, you know. Growth in health and beauty globally, adding dispensaries. And the key to their business really has been their loyalty program. I mean, their loyalty program is unsurpassed globally, and that's what's driven this growth. And we can discuss that in a bit more depth. But I think the South Africans have been retrospect, and even myself, to pay up for growth. And it's always traded, as it got into that significant growth phase, it traded at quite hefty multiples. It's now still on 27.5 times forward PEs.
Which means what? Year. What does that mean? What does that
which
mean?
It means, it mean, well, it means that effectively your starting yield, you're talking about yields on property stocks just before that, but a starting yield is just above 3%. So, you know, you're starting on a 3% yield and you've got to grow off that, and the dividend yield's probably even lower. So, you know, it's the foreigners are happy to pay that because they're guaranteed of earnings. I think the South Africans have always looked at it and thought that's a little bit chunky. But again, they've continued to deliver. I mean, you know, we had a relook at this business, you know, pre obviously the GNUs. We bought some in the portfolios because it was defensive going into what we thought would be a better South African environment. So we were lucky we did take some up. But certainly over the longer term, I think the biggest mistake we made as South African investors is firstly, we thought the big FMCG players would challenge Clicks in their home ground, i.e. in the dispensary home ground, and take away that market share. And certainly from a club card or loyalty perspective, we just didn't see how that could compound and keep compounding and growing at the rate which it has done. and where the other FMCG players just haven't been able to play there. They just haven't been able to make inroads into how good that club card effective Clicks has been. So I think if I look back over myself over this 25 years or so that I've been looking at this business, those are the mistakes that I've made, and I certainly think those are the mistakes that the South African portfolio managers have made. It's just to say, listen, really, this has been a fantastic business, and that growth vector, it's almost like a Capitec, that customer base just continuing to grow, and off the back of that, just continuing to add new services, and then dispensary coming online has obviously been that next big vector of growth for them in that Clicks business.
Such an interesting comparison you make there with Capitec, because Capitec's always been expensive, in inverted commas. You've always had to pay up for it. But if you had, you were well rewarded. Clicks, on the other hand, is a stock that you could have bought, sure, a third lower than the current price just before the Government of National Unity. So well done to you guys, because I know Sy's told us both at the conferences and in other interviews that 361 was looking for a positive outcome, and well done for going in there and, of course, reaping the benefit of it. But I guess where we are today, in the light of yesterday's results, are you comfortable that a company that's dividends up 14%, which is well above inflation, turnover, and I think inflation is now down to below 4 in South Africa, so that's good news, that the turnover was up 9%, this for the year to end August, that they gave us numbers that, again, for investors who haven't even ever looked at the stock, private investors, that they would be doing well by investing now, or must you wait for a retracement?
Alec, I think that, well, there's twofold. I mean, you're going to get, some of it's just geopolitical. If you get a Trump election coming in, you're probably going to have a bit of Rand weakness. You're probably going to get a better entry point. So, but that's very short term. Now, God, we've got 12 days now. So, and obviously, depending on the outcome of the election, would I jump right in at this very center? No, I don't think so. I think I'd wait a little bit, yeah. I think it's a great compounding story. If we look at their store growth, their dispensary growth, they're getting SEP pricing, which is single exit pricing on obviously drugs, which is a bit inflationary for them. But they've got quite a big headwind now in terms of all the FMCG guys have got quite a big headwind in terms of overall inflation into next year. So, you know, the tailwinds of that 7, 8, 9, 10% inflation that all the food guys have had, that's dissipated. You're probably going to see 3 to 4s. And off the back of that, you've probably got slightly lighter growth. So this is a stock now that I think if you've got, you hold. Did well. We started buying the stock when we saw it coming back to more palatable multiples, sort of around 21, 22 times forward. You know, we could sort of, going into a potential rate declining environment, et cetera, GNU, you know, we could pallet buying some. Now on 27 times, it's had a proper re-rating, as you said. I think I'd wait a little bit. I'd wait just for some geopolitical issues. Obviously, the big one being the Trump election and just what the potential outcome on the Rand could be. And then further than that, I think we've got a little bit of headwind coming. But certainly, Clicks has built enough pipeline. They've built enough store pipeline. They've built enough dispensary pipeline to still give us between 8 and 10% growth into next year.
936 stores, another 51 coming in the next year to the end of August. You mentioned their loyalty card, the Clicks card, 11.8 million members. That's a powerful base, a powerful tribe. We always talk about the BizNews tribe. We aren't at 11.8 million, I'm afraid. But but that has got to be the ace in the hole going forward.
No, Alec, you just summed it up there. I mean, this really, I mean, if we go back to when we initiated on this business, you know, when old Trevor Honeysett ran it and stuff, this business was at about 2 million club card members in the early 2000s to get to 12. You know, and that ability to keep customers in this cashback, this guaranteed cashback environment where the customer buys something, goes to the till and gets 50 Rand discount or 60 Rand discount on their previous purchases has been unbelievably powerful. It just hasn't been able to be replicated by any other retailers. ShopRite's doing pretty well with their one. I always use my wife as the proxy as to see what she's using. I'm pretty poor myself on these things, but I always have a look and see and the returns. But the Clicks return is just and the amplified return of double vouchers and additional promotional programs that go with the back of their loyalty program and how their supplier base supports that program as well. I think has been, you know, it's just that that really is the essence of their business. You know, obviously, as I said earlier on, health and beauty and dispensary and all those growth vectors are big global growth vectors. I think in South Africa, you know, people have also had to fund their own medication, you know, the front shop part of the pharmacy. I mean, not everyone's been able to get, you know, the cost of medical aids in South Africa is quite punitive. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, you know, pharmacies become, you know, and obviously government hospitals, et cetera, haven't been able to dispense to the same extent as they did could 15 years ago. So I think there's been a lot of other vectors that have been very well for them. And there was, but this club card is the essence of the Clicks business.
What does it tell us about South African companies being able to compete in the local market with international arrivals? And I'm starting there with, I remember talking to Wati Bason with the arrival of Walmart, and he said, let them come. And my goodness, they have certainly given Walmart and bloody nose here in South Africa with when Walmart bought Massmart. Now we've got Amazon coming in to take on Takealot. And in the update, the 100-day update from Naspers's new CEO, he said, let them come. We've got Takealot and we'll fight them off. And I guess, like many others, I was a bit skeptical that Takealot would be able to defend its turf against Amazon. But if you look at what Clicks and what you've explained about Clicks, if you look at what ShopRite has done, then I suppose it's a better than 50% chance that Amazon might also not be as successful as Jeff Bezos's successors are probably thinking.
Yeah, Amazon's a tough one to me. You know, it's a marketplace that to me just feels too small for Amazon to start with, and quite diversified. I mean, it's a very different marketplace to what Amazon is used to. I mean, obviously we've got big hubs in the likes of the Western Cape, you know, Gauteng, et cetera, Pretoria areas that we can play in. But you know, to get real scale in South Africa, you got to go a long way, you know, and you've got to really distribute quite far, and the critical mass is quite low. Takealot, funny enough, is doing a pretty good job. If I speak to people in small towns, I mean, they get a truckload of stuff coming in every day. Their price points are good. And, you know, I don't know what the total numbers of vendors that supply into Takealot today. But, wow, if you look, you can pretty much procure anything from a car rim to, you know, a fragrance. I mean, there's nothing you can't buy on Takealot. I mean, I've got neighbors that buy all their alcohol on Takealot today. I mean, they don't even bother to go to a bottle store. So, I mean, it's, yeah, it's quite a phenomenal business. But again, you know, I think, Alec, it's always, you know, the only economic term I really do love is that at the margin, you know. I mean, you know, if at the margin they take away a little bit of market share, it makes incrementally tougher for the other guys to grow, you know. And that's I think, you know, discussing even with Peter Engelbrecht 2 years ago, I mean, and I said to him, you know, at the time, you know who are you fighting as your biggest competitor, Pick and Pay or Spar? And he's going, no, Takealot. You know, I mean, that was 2-3 years ago, because Takealot really got their act together post COVID. You know, obviously people were buying a lot more online, and where they are good and where they are very sophisticated, these online guys, is they just know how to exactly price point off every single promotion, which the FMG guys are doing. And they can target it into regions virtually instantaneously because they get the delivery out there and make it quite advantageous to their business model. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the jury's still out on Amazon, but again, it's going to be tougher for the local guys, because you just have another big entrant with big capital come into the market, and they're not going to be under-resourced yet. I mean, it's maybe take them time to get to critical mass, but they're going to throw a lot of money at this, and I think that's the worry for the FMCG guys currently. I don't think such a big worry for Clicks, funny enough, because I think, you know, I'm not allowed to use the term Mrs. Housewife anymore. My wife said to me, that's not a term I can use on radio or TV. So we've got to be careful to use that term, Alec. But I think consumers today, I mean, I think they know what they want. And certainly from a dispensary / front shop / health and beauty, I think Clicks is, as I said, it still stands in that niche. But again, you know, with another big formidable, you know, in the US, Amazon did a big job coming to market, obviously, on the dispensary, says pharmaceutical side, and gave a big smack to the guys of like the likes of Walgreens, CVC, and all the big players in the US when they came to market. So, again, it's an interesting part of the market that we have to watch, we have to follow, and we often have to see, you know, what they're going to be offering clients and customers in that marketplace. Because if they do come and they do get dispensary licenses and they can eventually, you know, offer additions. I'm not saying they're going to do that initially. I think that's too complex for them. But, you know, further down the line, they've done it in other parts of the world, and it really has hurt the domestic players.
Battle Royal looming there. What about the Chinese as a last point in this fascinating discussion? And thanks for sharing your wisdom with us today, Evan. The Chinese competitors to Amazon and Takealot are doing stuff in South Africa. Could they get a foothold here?
They're doing a very good job. I mean, the Shein and this Temu, specifically Shein, I mean, their product range is quite phenomenal. I mean, I obviously look at friends and friends, families and kids and what they're buying, and, you know, even, and I'm surprised at even some of the quality that's coming through on this. I mean, and Shein, to me, the sector that, Alec, I've got really little feel for, obviously, and it's I shouldn't be saying this, but at this point in the juncture, this apparel market, you know, it's had a proper bounce since GNU, but, you know, to me, it's a very saturated market already. You know, a lot of space. You saw them, the Pick and Pay results, they rolled out another 10% space growth just in their clothing division alone. So the guys are throwing a lot of space at this market. There's a lot of capacity in this SA market. And then you've got these foreign entrants coming in, and these foreign entrances look quite dangerous to me. So specifically at the bottom end of the market, this bottom to middle end of the market, where people are a little bit cash strapped, and they're coming in with very attractive offerings delivered to your home. The return, obviously, you know, your return logistics in that type of the market is critical. But I mean, everyone I've spoken to, you know, it's just said, wow, how good it's been and how good the experience has been with these Chinese guys coming in, you know. So, yeah, this is quite key. I mean, they've obviously done, you know, they've done phenomenally well in the US and other parts of the world. And my sense is that they're doing pretty well here as well. It's not a market they're going to leave untapped. It's quite a big market. It gives them an avenue into African growth as well. And I think our apparel guys, you know, not so much the top end of the market, the Truworths, et cetera, but, you know, certainly the Mr. Prices, those guys, I think they're at risk of these Chinese coming into this marketplace. I really do. I think there's a lot of scope for these Chinese to grow here in an environment where they happy to tackle full on and they're not scared of throwing big capital at developing markets.
Evan Walker is with 361, and for my money, the top retail analyst in South Africa. As I mentioned earlier, we're grateful for him sharing his wisdom with us today. Well, we're still kind of on the Chinese story, because the Financial Times of London this morning in the FT News briefing reported on Vladimir Putin wanting to introduce a new BRICS currency. This has been part of the whole BRICS summit, which is being held in Russia this week. And it's we're going to have another Russia-related story in just a moment. But let's listen in on how the FT sees the possibility of a BRICS currency and its challenge to the US dollar.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has an idea to reduce countries' dependence on the dollar. It's a new international payments framework that he's been pitching at the BRICS summit this week. That's a meeting between countries including Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Putin thinks it'll help Russia and other countries work around U.S. sanctions. But the plan didn't seem to spark all that much enthusiasm. Charles Clover is the FT's foreign affairs correspondent, and he joins me now to discuss. Hi, Charles.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. So what exactly is Russia proposing here, and how would it work?
Okay, well, basically, the world trade and financial architecture is made up of banks sending each other money, and it's very, very hard to do that without the U.S. dollar. And there's a whole series of institutions that underlie this U.S. dollar-dominated financial network. And Russia has largely been blocked from all of that by U.S. sanctions following its invasion of Ukraine. So it is trying to create an alternative parallel system of a way for banks to send each other money and message each other about transactions that avoids the U.S. system. And it's using a lot of new technologies like blockchain and tokens, central bank, digital currencies. These are all very new and trendy things that the tech community thinks might one day replace the sort of the banking system and the Washington-dominated global sort of financial center.
Okay, and Russia obviously needs other countries to join too in order for this to work. So what happened at BRICS? Why the lack of enthusiasm for the plan?
Well, it's a good question because a number of countries like Iran, who's also a member of this BRICS organization, they've been largely shut out of the dollar. And so it's looking for a way to continue to conduct normal trade and finance. But I mean, basically, the real problem is, again, U.S. sanctions. So the U.S. has pledged to put secondary sanctions on any country that helps with the Russian war machine. And supporting a trading or financial platform that helps Russia violate sanctions would probably count as helping Russia and would invite sanctions itself.
So these countries would like to support this type of program, but they think basically the risks are too high because of the threat of U.S. sanctions.
Well, I think, yeah, that's definitely the big reason. But there's also just a lot of disagreement on details. And they may not see Russia as being necessarily the leader on a new kind of financial payments architecture or something like that. I think people are generally looking to China for leadership on this issue. They have their own payments platform called SIPS. But a lot, you know, all of these alternatives still have not had a lot of uptake. But I think at some point somebody will get it right. But the dollar is still going to be the dominant currency for years to come.
Charles Clover is the FT's foreign affairs correspondent. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to our partners at the Financial Times in London and to Peter Major, Modern Corporate Solutions, our go-to man on mining. Pete, lovely having you back on the show. Lots of mining results yesterday, so we need to work through them. We did talk to Andries van Heerden of Afrimat at the trading update stage. The actual numbers were released yesterday. The share price, a little bit higher, but it feels to me a little bit like clicks. What Evan Walker was saying a bit earlier was that clicks just kept delivering, and as a result, you should buy into the company even though it's highly rated because the momentum will continue. Now, with Afrimat, it's a highly rated company. Well, I believe so. You can correct me if you will. But in the last 4 years, it's done nothing, which kind of would be, if I'm stepping back and looking at it and saying, hang on, I'm buying into a company that's come a long way in 4 years at 2022 prices. Is this a silly conclusion?
No, it's a very good analysis. And you're right. It's almost like buying into a fund manager after he's had 8 great years, and then you give your money to him, and then he starts mediocre performance. You say, damn it, same story, you know. But Afrimat's different. I'll tell you why I think they're different. They're very good at doing whatever they decide to do. And we know they just started off at the bottom, you know, in just a little quarry, virtually Andres and his wife and a couple of friends, and the way he's grown the business. And the whole key here is he wants to keep growing. And he has got one of the highest ratings in the mining sector. He's been rated above the LZ on a PE basis, whereas we see all our other mining companies are usually trading below the LZ. That's because they're perceived as X growth. Afrimat, now, as you said, Alec, he hasn't outperformed the LZ in the last 4 years. So he's got a bit of indigestion here, if you look at some of the acquisitions he's done. And he gets through it. You know, he's finally got his coal mine, the anthracite story, doing pretty well. He got his iron ore. That was a difficult acquisition. Even though he thought he ticked all the boxes, he found a lot more gremlins in that acquisition than he planned, and he got through it. But also, you can look at these mining companies, and Afrimat's a pseudo mining company. They're very dependent on macro factors they don't have a lot of control over. So Afrimat was very dependent on ISCOR. They're very dependent on Transnet. They're very dependent on iron ore prices. So that's why he's diversifying. This is kind of like a Anglo-American 50, 60 years ago. And I think he's done a good job. The market didn't cane in very much with the big earnings drop because they saw how revenue was up so much. And they just know he's got to get a handle on costs, and he will. And Lafarge, he's got to digest. He needs some help on the anthracite. He can mine a lot more if the people just give him the property there. So a lot of negotiations with landowners. But yeah, it's hard to keep beating the Aussie year after year. And it's going to take a lot of work. But this is a growth company, I believe. Good management.
So a smart call always with a growth company is to buy it when it's out of favor, because you buy in when it's in favor. And as you say, it's a little bit like from where I come from with a horse. If it's 1-5 in a row, careful of backing it to try and win the sixth, because eventually the handicapper catches up.
Yeah, if it's good management, wait for him to stumble or wait for some macro unforeseen event that knocks it down. And that's how Buffett buys. You know, he finds good companies and he buys them kind of a low point. And you can't predict when it's coming, but you can hold back and say, I'm not going to pay when it's at the top. You know, everybody likes it. They're buying. I'm not going to buy it now. And I'll tell you, Pete Major never buys like that. And I've missed things that just keep on running. But I want to buy it when I know I got some insurance. And you almost always get a chance. The market never not gives you another chance.
We got to pick up on Buffett. You made the point there. He's not backing, for the first time that I can remember, the Democrat candidate in the presidential election. Let's say Trump wins. Let's say that, or even Harris wins. How's that going to affect the mining sector? Big question.
You know, Alec, you don't want to talk to Americans about this. They're too polarized. So I've been talking to foreigners. I had a pretty good talk yesterday with a very successful Russian businessman. But he says, I'm not too successful, Peter. Please don't call me an oligarch. But I don't know if he speaks for all the Russians. But surprisingly, they're wary of Trump, and they're hoping Harris gets in. They said she can be managed. You know, she's out of her depth, and there's people managing there, and they'll keep things in line. He says, Trump, nobody can manage Trump. So, well, sometimes it's funny. He keeps, one of the foreign enemies of the states or the people they bump heads with. Yes, he keeps them off balance. But I think the foreigners would rather take another 4 years of the Democrats, even with Harris there. You can't predict what she's going to do, but there's going to be tight guardrails put on her. Whereas we know Trump, he can go right over a guardrail.
But what does that mean for commodity prices? They are so important to South Africa. Our economy does well when we get Transnet right and commodity prices start improving. Hopefully Transnet's on the right rails, to use your analogy a moment ago. So if there were to be a crazy guy in the White House, or back in the White House, who can't be trusted to what he's going to do tomorrow, is that a good or bad thing for commodity prices and South Africa?
Yeah, it's not good. Not good for commodity prices. Not good for world economies. You want stability. People want some kind of assurance that looking forward to tomorrow, next week, and next month is going to materialize. And we're all joking, oh yeah, Trump's good for gold. Well, yeah, he is good for gold, but we've seen gold is unique. You know, commodities don't follow gold. Currencies don't follow gold. You know, even the cryptocurrencies is battling to outdo gold right now. So yeah, maybe he is good for gold, but we don't produce any gold anymore. You know, barely 100 tons a year. Hell, we do 120 of platinum, you know. So it's not good for South Africa. And I thought he would have won this election pretty easy after the Democrats dropped Biden and put in Harris. I thought he's going to walk this thing, but he can't contain himself. And the people around him definitely can't contain him. You know, and instead of coming out like a maniac and getting real personal and bordering on xenophobic and racist, you know, he could have acted like, hey, I've matured. You know, I'm going to be a much more stable, thoughtful president. I think he would have won this thing easy, but he can't hold back. You know, that's the Trump personality, the DNA. And yeah, that is scaring the world. The world doesn't want him, and I'm not sure they need him right now, but they might just get him. So it's instability.
Well, on things that we do have a better handle on, yesterday we had a raft of numbers coming production numbers from the Anglo-American camp coming out on the Stock Exchange News Service. And I asked you to have a look at them, particularly Anglo-American itself, Kumba and Anglo-Platts. Given that Anglo-Platts at some point in time is going to be spun off from Anglo-American, was there anything there that excited you or disappointed you?
I got a lot of reassurance out of it, Alec. Reading what Duncan wrote in Anglo-American, he's doing everything he said he's done. And I hear things in the market, but seeing's believing. And look, Anglos and Billiton have been neck and neck since 2009. So you always hear people bad-mouthing Anglos, or I hear it too often, and I don't know why. It's unjustified. And, hey, Billiton's a good company, but Anglo's a very good company. You know, they've got a great history. They've got great assets. Duncan's doing everything he said, and the market must agree with him because it's outperforming Billiton. So if it's outperforming Billiton, are you really in a rush to sell it and get shares in Billiton? Amplats, same story. Some of us call Craig Miller the Alan Windy of Anglo-American Platinum. You know, not just because they look alike. They got a lot of similarities in their personality. You know, they're very excitable. They're very approachable. And they're very, very positive. And the guys deliver. And, yeah, Amplats, you know, they said, hey, we're 10% down overall in this time last year. But we had a mill breakdown. And again, I say this because I'm a macro guy. Amplats is tied to the platinum price. It's a quality asset. It's well managed. Huge resources. Good cost control. And yeah, they're not paying the kind of dividend we saw Thungela and Kumba pay because they're a growth stock. They don't have to pay 11-12% dividends because they're perceived as a growth stock. But the platinum industry, it's hard to say it's a growth industry. It's kind of capped at 6-7 million ounces a year, whereas the gold industry, you know, 3,000 tons a year, 3,100 tons a year mine production. And here's world platinum production, 170 tons. But yeah, it's just, it's a different industry. It's related to economies. And there's not much Amplats can do about that, no matter who's managing it.
And Kumba, but, yeah. What was the iron ore producers' operational numbers? What did they mean to you?
Very similar. You know, they got problems with the ports of Transnet. They got a huge stockpile, 7.5 million tons at the mine, 1.5 million tons at the port. You know, what else can they do? Well, they told us what they can do. They're coming up with this very large dense media separation plant that's going to take their already high-grade ore to a very high-grade ore so they can get a premium price. Yeah, if you're constrained, if the South African infrastructure only lets you export 30, 35 million tons, well, make sure they're very high-value tons. So, and they got the resources. Hell, they tore apart a quarter of the planet out there. You can see it by satellite. Put those resources to use. So I'm really looking forward to that plant. You know, it gives them higher quality product. Because the share has followed the iron ore price. It's been falling for 4 years. And those were Looney Tune prices. You can see their unit costs are about $38 a ton. They want to keep their total costs below $50 a ton. So these iron ore, it should be illegal to have those kind of margins, you know, year after year. Whereas precious metal people, start with De Beers, platinum. You know, those guys, they're lucky to get half the margin, a third of the margin that the big bulk producers.
Just for that, iron ore get. For those who haven't been following it, where is the iron ore price today relative to that below $50 cost?
I think it's about $105, and I think they said they've averaged $94. And that was disappointing to me, Alec. Yeah, I thought they were going to average a much higher price than that because they've got a premium product. But I think we got to compare the world price with is that CIF delivery in China as opposed to, is it FOB? But yeah, we keep hearing the premium product. Well, we want an even higher premium product since they're limited on tons. But there's good upside there. You increase volume if the price falls. So hopefully the South African government can get Transnet back to where it should be, you know, get them so they can put another 10 million tons out. That'll really help the bottom line.
And to close off with, we had a question from a member of the BizNews community who wanted to know what's happened to Sedibelo Resources, Brian Gilbertson.
They say they're mined out. They had a little bit of a heyday during COVID. That mine never should have started, Alec. It was crazy. It was like standing at the Palabora open pit mine, looking down. You could hardly see the trucks down there, and you're mining a reef that's barely a meter and a half high. You know, there should be a law against open pit mines, and some countries are starting that. They're starting to ban them. Mexico's got a bill to ban open pit mines. But yeah, we have platinum coming out of our ears, growing on trees here. We don't need to tear a crater the size of that place to mine narrow reefs or multiple reefs of low grade. So unfortunately, Sedibelo met the fate of operations that never should have been started.
Peter Major from Modern Corporate Solutions, our man with the wisdom that you can, it just seeps through every pore in his body when we start talking about mining. My goodness, aren't we privileged to have him here on the BizNews platform. Well, we're going to close off with Irina Filatova, another national treasure. She is a professor, formerly at Moscow University, came to South Africa after 1994, and has been a professor at various other universities. She is Russian. She's from Russia. She has many friends there. And if anybody knows what's going on in Russia and the BRICS summit, well, Irina's the one. The big question we've had, as you've been following the BizNews briefing over the past few days, is this really dangerous situation where Vladimir Putin is now bringing in North Korean troops. And the implications of that are quite significant globally, including for South Africa. Irina Filatova spoke with my colleague Chris Stain, and particularly on this subject.
We are indeed on the cusp of a very difficult era. It remains to be seen how it is going to turn out.
Let's just go back to the battlefield. North Korean troops, hundreds of them, have been formed, training in Russia. Western allies believe that is for deployment in the war against Ukraine. And is that how Putin is going to try and retake Kursk?
Well, I don't have inside information about it, apart from the fact that it is not only the United States and its Western allies who believe that these troops are being trained for the participation in the Ukrainian war, but it is also the South Koreans, it is also all the Russian opposition specialists who watch these things very closely and have some internal information. Yes, they do say that there will be about 12,000 of these troops ultimately, which will take participation in the Ukrainian war, possibly in the Kursk region. Kursk itself has never been occupied by the Ukrainians, so it is only the Kursk region. Whether they would be fighting there, whether they would be fighting on the territory of Ukraine, that we do not know yet, but there is a kind of a consensus between the West, the South Koreans, and the Russian internal opposition sources, which agree that these troops are indeed going to be used in the war in Ukraine.
But what is the bigger implication of North Korea entering that war?
There are a lot of implications. First of all, it will have a much bigger and better relations with Russia. It gives it a leverage in the relations with Russia. It gives it the opportunity to claim and maybe get the latest Russian technology, which it was asking for quite a long time. So this gives it a better chance to get it. And then, of course, this will affect the whole situation in this region. But we should remember that this is not what China wants. China would not be very happy by too close relations between Russia and North Korea, and it won't be happy if North Korea gets this latest technology.
Do you think foreign deployment could turn that war around, or would it take more than that?
Look, the Ukrainian troops are exhausted. They have been fighting with the hands tied behind their backs in terms of what arms they can use and how they can use them. And of course, they don't have enough of these arms to fight with the Russian army and Russian war machine at home. Russia has more money, more men willing to die, or maybe not so much for the motherland. Some of them do want to die for the motherland, but many just go to get more money because they are very well paid for volunteering.
Professor Irina Filatova talking to Chris Stain. And we close off with a little bit of popular culture for you now. If you are one of the many fans of the Netflix series, miniseries on the Menendez brothers, you'll find this really interesting.
In Los Angeles, prosecutors have recommended resentencing for Eric and Lyle Menendez. These two brothers were charged with the 1989 killings of their parents in their Beverly Hills mansion. Here is L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon speaking earlier at a news conference.
I have to tell you unequivocally that we don't have a universal agreement. There are people in the office that strongly believe that the Menendez brothers should stay in prison the rest of their life, and they do not believe that they were molested. And there are people in the office that strongly believe that they should be released immediately and that they were, in fact, molested.
George Gascon is L.A. County District Attorney. Now, the high-profile Menendez case led to a media frenzy back in 1989 and 1990. It's come back to light recently following the release of a Netflix documentary earlier this month. Currently serving life sentences, these brothers may be eligible for release after the DA's recommendation.
That brings to an end our program for the week from our technical producer, Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer, Lucy Ferreira, and yours truly, Alec Hogg. We'll be back again on Monday at 7 a.m. Until then, cheerio.